Dr. B. Collins, news and comment. It's Wednesday, September 2nd, 2020. Your humble host is taking a longish break for the Labor Day weekend, and our next podcast will be Tuesday, September 8th. So I've grown pretty tired of the repeated claim of Donald Trump that the carnage on the streets of our cities, the urban upheaval, is the result of radical Democrat-run cities. The radical Democrat mayors preside over these towns, and they just let people run all over the place and all over the cops. And I appreciate a piece today at the New York Times, which provides some details to an argument that I've been making recently. And that is, start with this. 85% of American cities have elections that are nonpartisan. And while those nonpartisan candidates can become nonpartisan mayors, many of them are members of the Democratic Party. But these are not the kind of political machines that I encountered as a young man in Chicago, the Daily Machine, that was a Democratic-identified organization. And so Trump is living in the past, but many of his voters do as well. And so by blaming Democrats who run cities as nonpartisan mayors, he believes he is scoring points in the suburbs and in red state rural areas. And it's pure political propaganda. And he catapults the propaganda, as George W. Bush used to say, by constant repetition. And, of course, it shows up in his tweets, and we hear it from Trump supporters. It was a frequent refrain at the Republican convention online last week. So Emily Badger is the reporter responsible for this article. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. And it is fair to say that there are more people who identify as Democrats than people who identify as Republicans who are mayors of American cities. And here in California, I am aware of a Republican mayor in Fresno and Kevin Falconer in San Diego. And that's about it. Los Angeles was run by Dick Reardon. And he was a Republican who ran for governor and lost in the primary. So the article quotes a guy from my alma mater, Thomas Orgazalek, a political scientist at Northwestern University. A lot of those critiques are pretty cynical. They're saying, you can't solve these problems, so you're bad at governance. And we're not interested in solving these problems. We're going to stay out of that conversation until it gives us a partisan opportunity to win someplace else. And the mayor of Kenosha, Wisconsin, identifies as a Democrat. And so Trump has been repeating his attack quite a bit. But it's important to note that crime rates are actually dropping. We've had high-profile and televised disturbances that started as peaceful protests and led to a different outcome with looting, arson, a lot of tagging, and some confrontations with police. But a statistic by mid-July showed that only 18% of the George Floyd protests that started after Memorial Day involved any significant violence. So Trump is exaggerating, but he's aided and abetted by the Sinclair television stations we talked about yesterday, by Fox News, by the One America News Network, and by people who are willfully ignorant who follow Trump's tweets. And it's important to note that most mayors don't have much power. They are glorified heads of a city council. And yes, there are a few strong mayor positions across the country. But here in California, the mayor of Sacramento is trying to pass a charter amendment to enhance his authority because he doesn't have much. And I think that is fairly consistent with the level of authority that most mayors have. So here's a quote from a political scientist at Michigan State, Joshua Sapotichny. Sorry, Joshua, if I butchered your name. The assumption is that cities are city-states. What that means is that they have the autonomy to act on the preferences of their constituents. And that's not even true with respect to social distancing, mask mandates, and lockdowns on the COVID side. And we saw a number of states where mayors were overruled by their governors. In Atlanta, in Houston, and in a number of other places when it came to regulation related to the pandemic. So I think it's important to wrap a few facts around these casual claims that are easy for many people who are aligned with Trump to believe. Oh, yeah, it's the Democrats. And we rarely hear somebody ask if you're a Republican and you became mayor of, say, Chicago, which is a stronger mayor system. Would you be able to stop the gun violence that erupts almost every weekend there? Do you really believe that authoritarian approaches to protesters who are demanding police reforms and end up on the receiving end of a rubber bullet, a police baton, tear gas, whether it comes from the city police department or the National Guard? I don't believe so. And I'll reiterate that I don't condone violence. I think a lot of the looters were really stupid. And destruction of property may feel good for a moment when you're at your most angry. But in general, the people who do that are hurting themselves and their interests. It is extremely short-sighted. But if you don't address the underlying causes, there was Trump in Kenosha, Wisconsin yesterday, against the advice of the governor and the mayor and many residents. And he didn't talk about the underlying causes. When he was asked about systemic racism, he changed the subject. You have anarchists, and you have the looters, and you have the rioters, and you have all types, you have agitators, and that's what you should be focusing on with your question. I don't believe he uttered Jacob Blake's name in Kenosha. And apparently the White House reached out to Blake's mother, and when she said that she would talk with Trump with a lawyer present, or with a lawyer on the line if the conversation was by phone, the White House jettisoned their offer. So according to the account in the New York Times, Trump never mentioned Blake's name nor spoke with his family, brushed past the shooting, and called attention instead to the street violence that he blamed on liberal politicians. He expressed more empathy for police officers, saying they have a tough job, and occasionally some of them simply choke when put under tremendous pressure in carrying out their duties. So he's an apologist for police violence. Does he really think that that is going to persuade a young black protester who's currently out of work, has no prospects, on the verge of being evicted from an apartment, and feeling the long-term pain of being abused by cops? And this is where he is using this summer of rage to try to double down, paint all protesters as violent thugs and looters and rioters and agitators and anarchists. And I guess it works with his base. And he is hoping that it will shore up that base and get him reelected in November. And this guy, the sheriff of Kenosha, that's Kenosha County, David Beth, if you've seen the videos of him from past comments that he's made, he's quite a piece of work. And Trump lapped it up when Sheriff Beth said, "Thank you for being the president that likes law enforcement. On behalf of law enforcement, I'm telling you the group that's here, I hope you feel the love that they have for you and everybody who came." And that's the need of a narcissist. To be told by somebody who is pretty far out there, on the border of racism, I would say, to accept that praise. That's why Trump went to Kenosha. One of the photo ops he did was in front of a building that had been burned down by the protesters, call them rioters, that had been the site of Rhodey's camera shop. And the most recent owner, Tom Graham, was invited by the White House to participate in the walk-by. And he said no, he didn't want to have anything to do with Trump. He's not that political, but he knew that he would be used in such a situation. So instead, the White House found the guy who the camera shop is named for, who sold it to its current owner, Tom Graham, about 8 years ago, and trotted him out for the photo op, where I don't believe he got to say very much, but he was used as a prop by Trump. Now, today I'm sharing with you two reports, one from a blogger who I've never heard of before. His name is Andrew Valancourt. He goes by the tag Scrapper, and he blogs at Bullshido. So you get a sense, I guess, of his worldview from that. Nevertheless, he posted a piece that was, in turn, posted on Facebook by one of my conservative friends, a Trump supporter. And at first, I just scrolled right by, and then I said, yeah, maybe I'll take a look at this. And so in about 7 pages, Bullshido posted what he titled Anatomy of a Catastrophe. And he doesn't have a good thing to say about anybody involved in the street skirmish that led to 2 deaths and 1 man being wounded last week. And he writes how rampant stupidity killed 2 people in Kenosha. And I invite you to read it. I don't agree with every word, and it's loaded with invective, quite a few F-bombs. But fundamentally, he tries to apply objectivity to the events as we know them so far. He starts off by ridiculing Kyle Rittenhouse, the alleged shooter, and his mother, who reportedly drove him the 20 miles from Antioch, Illinois, to Kenosha, Wisconsin, last Tuesday. And she was the one who gave him access to weapons. I've seen pictures, if they're accurate. They show mom enjoyed going to the gun range, and she took her child with her. And we know that he was underage to be open carrying a weapon on the streets of Kenosha. He's not from Kenosha. He's from a neighboring state. And it is close. I don't want to make it seem like he drove all night to get there. But his youth, his inexperience, the way he was spooked when somebody fired a shot into the air. Well, the blogger here repeatedly notes that if Kyle Rittenhouse had left the scene and been able to leave the scene after that first shot into the air was fired, we might have seen no loss of life that night. And the blogger writes, this was supposed to be a peaceful protest over legitimate civil rights issues. However, there's no objective description of what was occurring on the street. Some of the protesting was much more akin to rioting. Now, I think that's true for Sunday night and Monday. I'm not aware that Tuesday night, when the shooting occurred, that the rioting continued. In another point, he says, it takes two to tango, but some people tango harder than others. For reasons not entirely clear, some of these disingenuous people singled out the young-looking member of the gun-toting idiots patrolling the streets and began harassing him. It's entirely feasible that Kyle somehow instigated this interaction. It's equally possible that he is seen arguing on camera with a guy who picked a fight. And he notes, had the grown adult men just laughed at his stupidity, we would have no incident to discuss. His next point, and by the way, we'll get to the criminal records of the two men who died in a moment, so just accept the description here. At some point, the convicted sex offender throws something at Kyle. It looks like Kyle's riled by the situation because he immediately attempts to retreat. This emboldens several of the protesters, including the guy who had thrown something at Kyle. And he writes, I still for the life of me can't understand the why of this. They had won. The silly men had gotten the boy to leave with his tail between his legs. Had they let Kyle run away, we have no incident to discuss. The bullies pursue the retreating Kyle. In the videos, Kyle is obviously in full retreat, but I suspect he had begun to realize that the life of a gunman on the street, he uses the term operator, I think that's a video game reference, is not the video game fantasy that he imagined. So then, under the heading Failure 3, oh dear God, this isn't funny anymore, some intellectual amoeba in the pursuing mob shoots a pistol in the air. It's on camera, and the moron was not even aiming at someone. He just lets one fly for the hell of it. Now, I think that there is another possible explanation here, but we don't know why that first shot was fired. It may have been just to throw people off balance and try to clear the area. But referring to Rittenhouse, he said if he had kept his dick in his pants and his booger hook off of the bang-bang, he could have finished his undignified retreat, learned something about the world, and left the scene. So after that shot was fired in the air, Kyle turns at the sound of it. One can only assume he is full-on panicking now, lacking the maturity or the training for this. A gun has been fired. He sees the same man who he'd been arguing with trying to grab his weapon. He fires multiple times with little control of his weapon. Four of the bullets strike his attacker. Witnesses report that other bullets bounced off the ground. He said, I think missing half your shots at a distance of less than 10 feet is pretty lousy. So then he goes on to say, the crowd began to descend on Kyle once more. He flees the scene. Seconds later, he trips and falls on his stupid face because he's not properly trained. He's a 17-year-old, out of shape. He's now into the shit so deep that he can't even see and chew gum at the same time. The incident could have ended with the only one fatality, but several protesters take advantage of Kyle's fall to physically assault him. First, Kyle was not a rampaging killer, nor did any of his behavior up to this point leave the impression that he was well-armed. I'm not sure what his point is there. If Kyle's past as cop-worshipping Trump supporter is relevant, then the criminal record of those who took him on, that is relevant as well. That's how objectivity works. Again, had the attackers let the stupid idiot run away, we have no incident. Now, I understand that perspective. But I do think in the case of Anthony Huber, who does have a criminal record, that he saw Rittenhouse involved in the shooting that deeply wounded, if he may not have been aware that the first victim was dead, but that he decided that he couldn't let this kid continue to run down the street with an AR-15. And there's no indication that Huber was involved in the first encounter that led to the first shooting and death. So then, in summation, well, before we get to that, there is a slam at the police. With no one else attacking, Kyle continues to flee. He flags down several cops as they drive by. The responding police are not interested in what he has to say. They don't let him speak. And this is certainly a failure on the part of the cops. Then he summarizes. The factors here were white privilege, a white kid illegally carrying an AR-15 shoots three people. Police incompetence, where do I start, he says. Every cop who interacted with Rittenhouse should be suspended and retrained. Failure of law and order, three convicted felons picked a fight with a kid. You cannot pretend how objectivity works. And finally, about gun control. Everyone who has any opinion on guns should be mad about or livid that Kyle was able to walk around with an illegal weapon without any consequences. So, again, I base every thought that is expressed here, but I think it is an interesting reconstruction of the events and an attempt at being honest about all of the parties. And in the blog post, there's a link to an investigative news site called Wisconsin Right Now. And I don't know the origins of this site, and the word right in there sends up a flag for a lefty like me. But in the article, they say, look, we think the public is entitled to know, but the fact that Anthony Huber and Joe Rosenbaum had spent time in prison does not make them guilty of anything necessarily last Tuesday night in Kenosha. Let me quote from them here. We don't think the criminal history of everyone shot and killed is relevant. We also don't believe that anyone deserves to be shot because they have a criminal history, and that's true of these three men. We also acknowledge that human beings are complex, and the men surely had good aspects to their personalities. What makes their criminal histories relevant for the public, at least to consider? The three men who were shot had placed themselves in the midst of a scene of violent unrest that for days, well, it's 2 days, included lawless anarchy. Well, I think that's a little extreme, but you take their point. So, in the case of Joe Rosenbaum, he had been imprisoned in Arizona for domestic abuse, disorderly conduct, and apparently a second charge of domestic abuse. There's nothing, there is a claim that has been on the internet that he had a sex crime with a child in his background, but a review in sex offender registry does not show any reference to Joe Rosenbaum. They did find his file from the Arizona Department of Corrections, where he was incarcerated from 2003 to 2013, and he was written up for a number of infractions. That is not unusual, but that is his record. Then we get to Anthony Huber, and if you recall, the day after the disturbance in Kenosha, I cited Steve Horn, the environmental reporter who's a frequent guest on this podcast, and his cousin was a good friend of Anthony Huber. and they did not mention that he had had any brushes with the law or that he had been in prison. So he had a case, well, let's see here. He had a disorderly conduct conviction from 2018 as a domestic abuse repeater. That's a misdemeanor. He also had a forfeiture case for possessing drug paraphernalia. He had a case from 2012, second-degree recklessly endangering safety that was dismissed. He pled guilty to a strangulation and suffocation felony and a false imprisonment charge. And that led to his record from 2016 to 2019, where he served time at three different prisons in the state of Wisconsin. So again, I don't wish to upset people who honor Anthony Huber, who believe that he was acting heroically by trying to stop a reckless, heavy, young, gun-toting white guy. He used his skateboard as a weapon. But I think people are entitled to know the facts. And often in these cases, we get caught up in the kind of easy opposition to the police, and this was an egregious case where you cannot justify the level of violence that was used on Jacob Blake. And so, meanwhile, trying to follow their leader, two Republican members of Congress are directly attacking black protesters and, of course, exaggerating the risk that is posed by peaceful Black Lives Matter protesters. So Clay Higgins, Republican congressman from Louisiana, posted a photo of armed black protesters on his Facebook page and wrote that if they showed up in his state, they won't walk away. "I'd drop any 10 of you where you stand," Clay Higgins wrote. "Nothing personal. We just eliminate the threat. We don't care what color you are. We don't care if you're left or right. If you show up like this, if we recognize the threat, you won't walk away. We don't want to see your worthless ass, nor do we want to make your mothers cry." Now, his claim that we don't care what color you are really it tests any credibility of this man, because we know that white men armed with guns can go into a state capitol, whether it's Madison or Lansing, and only get approval from Republicans. And another one, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, told his constituents that the killing of African Americans by police have been sensationalized, said there isn't a problem of systemic racism. "What is systemic?" he said. "That means if there's a system, someone had to create that system. Someone is operating and nurturing the system to keep it going. I don't know who in our country is doing that." And asked whether the deaths of black people by police is a signal of a systemic problem, he said the only thing that has changed is the sensationalism of these events. So in an outing today where Trump went to North Carolina, in particular, and gave a speech on the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, he honored people who were veterans, and then he went on to say, "American warriors didn't defeat fascism and oppression overseas, only to watch our freedoms be trampled by violent mobs here at home. These people only know one thing, and that's strength. That's all they know, strength." And that's an echo of one of Bill Clinton's favorite phrases. He used it in the context of foreign policy. But he said Americans would rather be wrong and strong than be right and perceived as weak. Joe Biden will be visiting Kenosha tomorrow, and he has been getting tougher in his speeches that challenge his opponent, Donald Trump. Today, he said that the police officers who shot Jacob Blake and Breonna Taylor in Kentucky should be charged. "I believe we should let the judicial system work its way. I do think there's a minimum need to be charged the officers, as well as with Breonna Taylor." He went on to say, after a reporter asked him, that he believed the person responsible for the killing of Jay Danielson of the Patriot Prayer Group in Portland last Saturday night, that that person should be investigated and charged if the facts warrant it. So I consider these relatively safe positions to take, but Biden has been basically biding his time, and I didn't mean that as a pun, and waiting to really begin this campaign in earnest, and it appears that he is taking the gloves off and ready to do so. But I feel compelled to you another incoherent moment from Joe Biden. This occurred on Pittsburgh, on Monday in Pittsburgh, pardon me, where he went to, he's in some sort of a former steel warehouse, and he spoke to an empty room. There were five or six people from his staff and the video crew there, and gave a speech from a prepared text where at some point this 12-second clip has been pulled by supporters of Trump and is being circulated to say that Joe is losing it and he's incoherent.
In this year, just since the outbreak, it's taken more than 100 years. Look, here's the lives. When you think about it, COVID has taken this year, just since the outbreak, has taken more than 100 years. Look, here's the lives. When you think about it.
So this was posted on Facebook last night. It originated at PJ Media, which is a right-wing supporter of Trump. And I fired back at the guy who posted it was a fellow who fired me from a radio station. I don't consider him a good friend. But I said, look, Biden and Trump both speak different dialects of gibberish. And I cited the interview that Trump gave on Monday to Laura Ingraham of Fox News, where he babbled as he danced around a question of how he reacted to the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Then he went into his rant about thugs on a plane. And my Facebook contact, I won't call him a friend, responded that the thugs on a plane thing was coherent. So it's amazing to me that as a lefty, I can acknowledge that Joe Biden has these moments where he lapses into incoherence. But Donald Trump operates that way all the time. He can't complete a sentence. He interrupts himself. He interrupts his own thoughts. He falls back on a handful of words that he repeats over and over. And when he doesn't want to answer a question is when it's really obvious and apparent. In another speech that Biden gave today, he attacked Trump for spending too much time on Twitter and failing to address the need for national standards about reopening our schools. He's offered nothing but failure and delusions, Biden said. If Trump and his administration had done their jobs early on in this crisis, American schools would be open and they'd be open safely. He addressed Trump and said, Mr. President, where are you? Get off Twitter and start talking to congressional leaders. You always talk about your ability to negotiate. Negotiate a deal, he said, related to the stalled coronavirus package. So I do appreciate that Biden is standing up. But these moments where he can't read and can't explain what he's thinking, they are deeply troubling. And I know a lot of Democrats who just don't want to hear about it. They think somebody like me, who's a leftist but not a Democrat, should just ignore the weaknesses of this candidate. But I'm sorry. I won't be doing that. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work and my independent voice here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Mary Vogt, Jason Ferguson, Joey Perillo in Philly, and Faith Peoples, who is a loyal subscriber with more subscriptions than I can keep track of. Thanks to each and every one of you. And should you like to subscribe, all you have to do is drop by peterbcollins.com/signup, and you have options. Well, as we know, Trump has been ranting and raving for months about how if people vote by mail, oh, like he does, that the election will be rigged and it's the only way he could lose, he says. So now, the Trump campaign has spent $200,000 on Facebook ads since May, disparaging voting by mail. And now, they're working the other side of the street with a $650,000 buy on Facebook over the past week alone, encouraging his supporters to request absentee ballots. The ads read, "President Trump needs you to request your ballot. This is the election of our lifetime." And the theory here is that more Democrats than Republicans, this shows up in the polls, are requesting those mail-in ballots and plan to use them. And that Trump is demanding that the results be clear on election night. So in the New York Times today, Tripp Gabriel takes this subject on under a story headline, "This is Democrats' Doomsday Scenario for Election Night." And I heard Rush Limbaugh talking about this yesterday. And his inference was that Trump will win in the votes that are counted from the polling places on election night, and then he will lose during the backroom counting by Democrat-controlled voting officials who will manipulate the mail-in ballots to lead to his defeat. Now, that's a pretty paranoid view, but it serves the interests of this president and the way he has been attacking mail-in balloting. And there's history here. Back in 2018, in Florida, which Trump now claims is his primary residence, there were Republicans running for governor and Senate. And on election night, it appeared that Rick Scott, the former governor running for Senate, and his Republican replacement Ron DeSantis were losing. And then Trump said large numbers of new ballots out of nowhere. An honest vote count is no longer possible. Ballots massively infected. So because on election night, it appeared that the Republicans were in the lead, Trump said, well, we've got to shut this down and go with the election night numbers. Only ultimately, after all of the ballots, including mail-in ballots, were counted, both Republicans won. I think this gives us insight into the stable genius and how he thinks. And now we are learning. Oh, here are the numbers, by the way. 47% of Biden supporters plan to vote by mail, but only a third of Trump supporters, about 34%, plan to vote by mail. And get this, 12 states do not allow mail-in ballots to be processed before Election Day. And that includes Michigan, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And the secretaries of state are asking for legislative changes so that they can process those ballots when they are received. And here in California, shortly after the polls close on election night, it's the absentee ballot results that are first announced. Then about 2-3 hours later, they start to trickle out the polling place results from that day. So this would not be the first time that a Republican would jump out ahead and claim victory before all the votes are counted. Bush did it in 2004. And once that is set in the people's mind, then it appears that the additional tallies are somehow part of election fraud, that leads to rigging of the outcome and therefore invalidates the results. Well, there is a new insider White House book. It seems like one's coming out every day now. This one is called Melania and Me by Stephanie Winston Wolkoff. And she's a New York socialite who was best buddies with Melania, even went to work for her at the White House after being one of the major managers of the inaugural events. And last night, Ms. Wolkoff was a guest on Rachel Maddow's show. And in the lead-up, Rachel read large portions of the book, a lot of juicy gossip about Melania, most of which I don't care about. You know that she doesn't like Ivanka, and they are rivals who fight it out. But the most important part relates to the management of the inaugural and the funds. They raised $106 million. And Wolkoff billed the committee for $25 or $26 million, but most of that went to vendors. So where is the other $75 to $80 million? Well, Wolkoff told Maddow that at one point, the Trump Organization was trying to charge outrageous, obscene, marked-up fees for use of the Trump Hotel right down the street from the White House. And they appeared to bill for events that hadn't even taken place in six figures. So Wolkoff makes it clear that she was selected as the one who had to take the fall. And once that happened, Melania coldly turned her back on her. And the gossipy stuff I don't care about. But Maddow also pointed out that Elliot Broidy, who was a co-chair of the convention, the inauguration, also a major fundraiser, he tried to trade on that to gain influence for clients in the Emirates, other parts of the world, and he has now been indicted, she reported last night, although I don't see that in accounts published today. Also, the book reveals that Melania Trump used a personal email account and encrypted messaging apps like Signal to conduct government business. And you would think that the Trumps, I mean, Ivanka has been accused of this as well. I believe Jared, the crown prince, used his personal email and got caught. You would think after the way they vilified Hillary Clinton that they would be more careful about that. But they're not, so I'll chalk that up to bad optics. And another event which is bad optics occurred in San Francisco the other day when Nancy Pelosi went into a hair salon and got a wash and blow dry. And this has been blown up by Fox News into a national scandal. And it's fair that the beauty salons in San Francisco are not permitted to conduct indoor operations right now. The rules will change, we're told, in October. And yes, there is an element of hypocrisy here, that Nancy's hair is more important than yours. And it ranks up there with this summer when she did a video that was online about the $14 pints of ice cream that are in her freezer. Come on, Nancy. You're smarter than that. But she wasn't very smart in her pick in the Massachusetts Senate primary, where she chose to turn her back on Ed Markey, who's been in Congress for 89 years, even though he's only 74. And he was challenged by the much younger Joe Kennedy. Pelosi went with Kennedy, and that violates one of her longstanding policies not to endorse in primaries one Democrat over another. Markey was winning with about 54% of the vote when Kennedy conceded last night. And in a race that was widely watched, Richie Neal, the grifting chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee and a key member of Pelosi's caucus, he easily fended off Alex Morse, who is the mayor of Holyoke, Massachusetts, and who was smeared quite a bit by Richie Neal's campaign along the way. Here's today's COVID-19 update, and I want to thank Linda Lewis for getting it started today. She's not feeling well, and so I finished it up. The statistics for you, 25.7 million global confirmed cases, 857,000 deaths reported. In the United States, it's almost 6.1 million cases and 184,000 plus deaths. And as we have seen over the past few weeks, the numbers start to build as the week goes on. And I don't understand this. It should be pretty much spread over every day of the week. But today we're showing 44,000 new cases. Yesterday it was in the 30,000 range. And 1,091 deaths. Yesterday only 488 deaths nationwide were reported. And I don't know if this is a symptom of the manipulation of the data, or if this is just factually how these statistics are being made by positive tests and by fatalities. The National Institutes of Health yesterday released a statement undercutting the Food and Drug Administration's emergency authorization of convalescent plasma as a coronavirus treatment. And this is an escalation of an extraordinary public disagreement between federal agencies. You'll recall a week ago Sunday, on the eve of the Republican confab, Trump held a news conference, trotted out, Robert Hahn, head of the FDA, who then dutifully reported that convalescent plasma had reduced fatalities by some 30%, but was unable to supply any supporting testimony or evidence. Meanwhile, cheap, readily available steroid drugs that were used to treat people with COVID-19 in the hospital have cut the risk of death by one-third, according to an analysis encompassing seven different clinical trials. The analysis of the drugs was conducted by the WHO and published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Corticosteroids are the first treatment shown to improve the odds of survival for critically ill COVID patients. And Linda notes that she was reading The Guardian online and came across disturbing stories about an Australian politician expected to become the UK's trade envoy. And that would be former Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott. And he has been nominated by Boris Johnson to become a trade envoy for the United Kingdom. He has railed against COVID health dictatorships, saying the economic cost of lockdowns meant families should be allowed to consider letting elderly relatives with the virus die by letting nature take its course. Yeah, just thin the herd. He claimed it was costing the Australian government about $200,000 to give an elderly person an extra year of life. He said not enough politicians are thinking like health economists trained to pose uncomfortable questions about the level of deaths we might have to live with. So he is placing the value of money and jobs over the life of people, and it's fair to say that a lot of the victims of whose deaths are attributed to COVID-19 are elderly, do have other health problems. But I simply don't want to be the person to make that decision. The death panels, remember what Sarah Palin warned us about? Well, Nick Cohen at The Guardian, who is no progressive, describes former Prime Minister Abbott as a product of the global network of right-wing think tanks. Describes him as a failed Australian politician who will be remembered that way. We're learning that the first death tied to the massive motorcycle rally in Sturgis, South Dakota in July has been reported. And this was a man from Minnesota in his 60s who reportedly had underlying health conditions. Now, more than 50 cases in Minnesota alone have been traced back to the Sturgis rally. Other reports have surfaced in 11 other states. And the seat, Meade County, the site of the Sturgis rally, had only 71 coronavirus cases reported during the first 6 months. That number has now more than tripled to 305. Trump's new doctor prop at the White House, Dr. Scott Atlas, on loan from the right-wing think tank, the Hoover Institution here at Stanford. He's the guy with no experience in immunology or infectious diseases. And he is advancing arguments about achieving herd immunity in a similar way, just by letting people die. And while I'm leery of the vaccine that is being rushed to be jabbed into people's arms, the experts say that we can't reach herd immunity without a functional vaccine. And Tom Frieden, a doctor and the former CDC director, said, trying to get to herd immunity other than with a vaccine isn't a strategy, it's a catastrophe. And Joni Ernst, who is desperately trying to hold on to her Senate seat from Iowa, she is now dabbling in that theory that Trump promoted in a tweet the other day. And that is by cherry-picking the death data. They figured out that only about 9,000 or 6% of the reported fatalities in the United States came exclusively from COVID-19. And while I recognize that, as I've said repeatedly, the data are hardly reliable, the definition of a COVID death versus a death with COVID is very hard to parse. The data are not as specific to tell us that. Many of the determinations about a cause of death were made by ambulance technicians or family members, particularly those who didn't die in a medical facility and who had not been tested. But the idea that the numbers we're being given are inflated by 94%, frankly, I just don't believe that. I think it's fuzzy math, and I think it's a pathetic effort by Trump to continue to try to keep his numbers down because he's embarrassed by them. Well, it's a big headline at BuzzFeed. Facebook has removed fake accounts from a Washington PR firm and Russian trolls. The PR firm mostly aims its 26 fake Facebook accounts at Latin America, Venezuela, Mexico, and Bolivia. And then there is the infamous Internet Research Agency, St. Petersburg, Russia. And Facebook reports that an IRA page was the 100th that they removed in August. But then when you look at independent sites that evaluate the traffic and the number of people who actually see these posts, it is pathetic. One of the posts coming from St. Petersburg only had a couple of hundred engagements. And while I believe that Russia and Russian businesses do engage in online trolling, I think it's mostly for commercial benefits. They want to make money. They're working on their capitalism thing. And from 2016 to this day, I can see no evidence of significant impact of these so-called influence campaigns. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is convinced that the Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, was poisoned, citing what she called unequivocal evidence. She demanded an explanation from Moscow. Quote, Navalny has been the victim of a crime. It raises very serious questions that only the Russian government can and must answer. So let me say that this may be true. It could be a nerve agent from the Novichok family. But they then cite the Skripal poisoning in Salisbury, England in 2018, where they never firmly established that Novichok was the cause. They just told us stories. The two guys came from Russia, and they put it on the doorknob of the Skripal residence. But when you scrutinize it carefully, the episode doesn't make sense, and we don't have evidence that Novichok was used. And then there is the British Chemical Weapons Lab that is located just outside of Salisbury, England. So again, I don't claim to know what happened to Navalny. It could have been a poisoning attempt. I do not say that Vladimir Putin can't or doesn't engage in such atrocious activities. But I'm not willing to simply take it on the word of Angela Merkel or anybody else. In an example of our arrogance and claim of American exceptionalism, we've done it again. President Law and Order is working to undercut the efforts of the International Criminal Court based in The Hague in the Netherlands, where our listener George Mashke hangs out. And so we've done it again. We've imposed sanctions on the chief prosecutor of the ICC. Her name is Fatou Bensouda. And Mike Pompeo announced the sanctions. And of course, the reason is that the ICC is investigating war crimes in Afghanistan, they say, by all parties. But the U.S. says the rules do not apply. Law and order is just a slogan for consumption in the United States. And The Guardian reports, this gets a little complicated, but back in 2018, a team from the Justice Department was dispatched to Texas to examine the issues related to child separation of migrants. And a Justice Department prosecutor who was on that team, named Joshua Stern, was clearly troubled by what he saw. He told colleagues he was disturbed by the separation of children from their parents. And so, in retaliation, a Trump ally, who has now been nominated to a lifetime appointment on a federal court, entered the picture. Her name is Iris Lan, a senior official working in the office of the Deputy Attorney General in Washington. She has not yet been confirmed by the Senate, but they claim she is highly competent and apolitical. But the report says she intervened, and shortly thereafter, the lawyer who had gone out of bounds, his name is Stern, Joshua Stern, was fired from that assignment. And finally today, I don't have any reports of nasty incidents on the streets of Portland last night, but Monday night the protesters targeted Mayor Ted Wheeler, and they protested outside his condo tower. Well, he has announced in a letter to all of his neighbors, there are 114 units in that building, that he'll be moving soon. And he apologized for the damage to our home and the fear that you're experiencing due to my position as mayor. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. Have a great Labor Day weekend. My next report in your ear on Tuesday, September 8th. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.